Support for The Source on Utah Public Radio comes from the USU Utah Water Research Laboratory and the USU College of Agriculture and Applied Sciences, celebrating the 2015 Year of Water, water expertise at its source. And iUtah, helping to shape Utah's water future through statewide research, science, and education.
So how do you want to start this thing?
This is The Source. I'm Jennifer Pemberton.
I like it. I like it.
And who are you?
Well, I'm Ross Chambliss.
And we're doing this together.
We are. We are together. We're united.
Finally. Ross, in every single episode, I think you were not in the first episode, but
right.
In every other episode of The Source, reporting on water issues, being my man on the ground in Salt Lake City, when I was staring down at 12 months of 12 hours of water programming, at first I thought, oh, this is going to be no problem. Water is sort of endless. There's a sort of bottomless supply of stories. But then every month, I would think, how can we talk for an entire hour about water?
Right.
So I started to sort of feel the effects of the drought a little bit. I was like, maybe there isn't as much water stories out there as I thought there were. And, you know, I loved having another voice and bringing you in and knowing that we could, you know, at least between the two of us, with some help from a couple other people, try to tell the stories that were out there. And every month it happened, every month I would come up with something. Usually I would either have a story in mind that I wanted to build around, or I would just pick the topic and say, I bet we can find 4 stories about drought this month, or I bet we can find stories about this. And I think that's how I would sort of approach you and be like, hey, here's the topic.
Yeah.
What do you got?
Yeah. Drought. Go out and find it.
Yeah, go.
Go tell something about it. Yeah, and I'll just say one more thing for me, I guess professionally, because, you know, my real job or my day job is I'm a producer at KCBW in Salt Lake City. And being a producer means that 90-95% of the time, your voice really isn't out there. You know, I'm actually making other people sound good. I'm kind of pulling the strings and sitting behind the computer most every day. And this opportunity gave me a chance to go out into the field and record some tape and actually to use my own voice to tell some of these stories.
We got to go out in the field, which is really great. I mean, sometimes we did a couple of studio interviews and some phone interviews, but we got out there. I mean, Ross got to go out on the railroad causeway in the middle of the Great Salt Lake, which I was super jealous about that one, too.
Right. And which is private property, so it was a little sketchy, but he didn't get arrested.
Ross also got to ride on the Marsh Master, a Phragmites destroying machine in the wetlands of the Great Salt Lake. He got to wear waders and hike up a stream to a massive beaver dam complex. But he also covered a lot of policy and legal issues that, frankly, I didn't want to get into. In May, Ross examined a particularly contentious legal battle on the show that was between private property owners and recreationalists who want access to public rivers and streams. We have an update on that story. I'll let Ross take it from here.
Back in early May, I spoke with Chris Olson. He leads the Utah Stream Access Coalition. We spoke about the 2010 Public Waters Access Act, or HB 141. This was the state law that took away access to any rivers flowing across private property, an estimated 2,700 miles of Utah's rivers and streams. The bill was introduced very abruptly at the end of the 2010 legislative session, with very little chance for public comment, and it was passed and signed by the governor. Ever since then, Olson's group has been battling to have that law overturned.
And we spoke, the last time we spoke, it was just after you guys had had a victory. And I understand that there was, you had kind of two legal options for overturning it. One was sort of questioning the navigability case of the law, and the other was sort of the constitutionality of the case. And when the last time we spoke, you guys had just won this navigability case, but it was only for a small section of the Weber River, right? So at that time, the 2010 Waters Act was still really the law of the land.
It still, you know, and it still was. So that happened in May when we were last here. And what Judge Kelly ruled in that case was that a one-mile stretch And actually a very disjoint 1 mile stretch on the upper Weaver was navigable. And so what that means is that the title to those lands, based on the legal argumentation that happened, at time of statehood, that title should have been transferred to the state. And because this river was useful for the benefit of the people. Mm. So that case now has been appealed to the Utah Supreme Court. And we're waiting to hear from them. I think we're actually right in the midst of filing briefs on that right now to go through navigability.
And so that was the Weaver River case.
That's correct.
And then you had your second case, which dealt more with the Provo River and the overall constitutionality
yes.
of the case. And that decision happened around early November, right? Can you say what happened?
Yeah, so after we got done with the Weaver case, in September we had five or six days of trial, I believe, with Judge Pullen in a different district court. And this was a case that we filed on the Provo River. And it basically, as you mentioned, it was to challenge the constitutionality of this House Bill 141 of the Public Waters Access Act. The argument that we had there was that, you know, when the legislature goes and regulates a resource, this, you know, that's the job of the legislature to do that. But when they do that, if they don't do it for the benefit of the people, then they're acting outside of what's called the public trust. And that was our argument, is that the legislature exceeded their bounds and went too far. And by giving away 43% of the public's resource, they were in violation of the public trust doctrine. And Judge Pullen and the district court agreed with us.
Okay. Yeah, so this constitutionality case dealing with the Provo River was really sort of examining what had been lost or to some degree, you know, all of this public land or this public resource of our rivers and streams had basically been privatized, sort of trying to estimate what the damage was.
Correct? Yeah, it was twofold. There was many rounds. This went through the courts for 5 years before we finally got this this final judgment. But what Judge Pullen was asking at the very end was, first of all, what was lost? And second, what is the impact on what remains? And I think he very astutely pointed out in his ruling that, you know, if X, Y, and Z State Park are taken away, the fact that you can go recreate in these other lands is of little consequence because the scope of what was taken was so great. So by taking away 43% of the rivers and streams of the state, it's basically impossible for there to not be an impact on what's left.
Since Judge Pullen's decision, the case is on appeal to the Utah Supreme Court. In fact, both of their cases are on appeal. They expect to return to the court in the next couple years to challenge those appeals to preserve the stream access that they've gained. For the time being, the Stream Access Coalition has cautioned their members, who include anglers and other folks out recreating on streams adjacent private property.
Why is it important to be careful now?
In Judge Pullen's ruling, it returns us back to what was the Knatzer decision back in 2008. And while the Knatzer court said, yes, the public does have a right to touch the riverbeds while recreating in their resource, it didn't give a limit on what that easement was. It didn't define, all right, is this all the way up to the ordinary high water mark where the river rocks turn into grasses and you end up getting woody vegetation and that sort of thing. So we're cautioning people because we don't want people to exceed the limit of the easement. We don't want people to exceed the ordinary high water mark. We don't want people to get in a situation where they are, you know, trespassing and really trying to diffuse any of these conflicts so, you know, we can show that just like in Idaho and Montana and some of these other states, landowners and anglers and recreators can get along just fine together.
And another quick follow-up to a story that Jennifer reported back in October, the Utah Division of Wildlife Resources STD of the Sea campaign.
Always practice safe boating. Don't infect Utah's lakes and streams with a skiff-transmitted disease.
Invasive mussels start out as microscopic villagers.
The STD implicated in these ads is actually a family of freshwater mussels, zebra and quagga mussels, that have found their way into Utah's lakes where they reproduce rapidly and cause a lot of problems.
One of the DWR's other education campaigns to warn us about those invasive quagga mussels is just underway.
Welcome to the first annual Quagga Bowl at Lake Powell, where the aggressive spread offense of the quagga mussels will line up against the defenses from Brigham Young University, the University of Utah, and Utah State University.
This competition of sorts kicked off back in September. Basically, the division took three football helmets from the state's three biggest universities and submerged them in an undisclosed location in Lake Powell, where there's a known quagga mussel outbreak. The mussels like to cluster on hard surfaces below the water, and the helmet for the team that can hold off the most quagga mussels wins the game.
Really, it's designed to ultimately show how quickly quagga mussels can spread within lakes and reservoirs, given the opportunity.
This is Nathan Schwabach. He's the communications director for the Utah Department of Natural Resources.
So there are confirmed quagga mussels in Lake Powell. It's an invasive species that originated in Europe and has the eastern United States has been dealing with it for quite some time. It eventually made its way to Lake Mead and then to Lake Powell. Deer Creek is considered a suspect water at this point in time, and what that means is that at one point in time there was a sample taken in the water that showed a juvenile quagga mussel, and so that puts it in a state where we need to do consistent testing for several years, ongoing testing to determine if quagga mussels are in fact in that body of water or if that was perhaps a dead quagga mussel that was transported somehow and never began to populate.
I see. So the concern is that really about containing this to where it is right now in Lake Powell, it could cost the state millions of dollars and cause all sorts of pollution in the waterways, et cetera, if this were to spread.
Absolutely.
Right?
Quagga mussels, given the opportunity, will destroy ecosystems. They impact recreation. You know, for example, you could have quagga mussel shells lining lake shores and impacting recreation that way. And then given the opportunity, they can also clog and damage water infrastructure, so which could lead to millions of dollars in ongoing maintenance to keep those infrastructures performing accordingly.
So last year's football season came and went, but the division recently decided to extend the Quagga Bowl until next season.
We have a great, solid foundation of quagga mussels on all three helmets. We've decided to leave them in up until the start of next football season, and by that time you're going to see the tremendous impact that quagga mussel can have, given the opportunity to attach itself to something.
Okay, and so and how we're sort of scoring this competition is not by the higher the number of mussels is the winner, but rather the fewer the number of attached mussels is actually the winner. Is that correct?
It will actually be weight-based, and it will be the least amount or the least amount of weight will win. If there's no official prize to this, but we are tracking it.
Okay. And I guess there might be some of our listeners who might wonder if there's any sort of science being tested behind the use of these helmets, you know, perhaps if the mussels might be attracted to any particular color or the way they're placed down there or, you know, something like that.
Yeah, we joked about that. And actually, I asked that question to our biologists and our invasive species experts. No, we don't anticipate any of this data being skewed by color or anything like that. You know, personally, my hope was they'd be more attracted to red than they would be to the blue, but that's not the case.
We'll have more updates and reminiscences from the past year when The Source continues after a short break.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Donald Trump has said he is skipping the final debate before the Iowa caucuses.
They're dealing with somebody that's a little bit different. They can't toy with me like they toy with everybody else. So let them have their debate, and let's see how they do with the ratings.
We'll have the latest on the Republicans in Iowa and that debate. That's next time on Here and Now.
Join us this morning at 11 on Utah Public Radio.
Thank you.
It is clear that communities in northern Utah, the Uinta Basin, and Utah County need to clean up the air out there. So why do we continue to idle our cars, take short trips around the neighborhood, and avoid public transportation? Utah Public Radio wants to know what it will take to get you to take action. The conversation continues. Share your insight at upr.org.
Support for The Source on Utah Public Radio comes from iUtah, helping to shape Utah's water future through statewide research, science, and education. And the USU Utah Water Research Laboratory and the USU College of Agriculture and Applied Sciences, celebrating the 2015 Year of Water, water expertise at its source.
This is The Source. I'm Jennifer Pemberton. Ross Chambliss and I are in the studio together for the first time in nearly a year of producing The Source together.
You know, behind every hour of The Source, there's probably, I don't know, how many hours we call, you know, left on the cutting room floor, basically. Mm-hmm. This is an old metaphor from when there used to actually be tape that people would actually cut, which luckily I wasn't in radio at that time because it sounds incredibly tedious. But but that does mean that my hard drive is full of files that didn't get used. I feel like it's probably like icebergs, you know? It's like 10% is on the surface and the rest of it is all sort of lurking below.
Right.
We did a lot of reporting. I spent a lot of time out there talking to people and doing things. And I wanted to give the chance for maybe some of those stories to see the light of day and get swept up off the cutting room floor. Was there anything that you sort of didn't get to tell or had to get cut, didn't have time? Like,
sure, certainly. I can think of a few examples, actually, that from this past year where reporting on some stories for The Source, that there was just a few details that I, you know, I was thinking about later after the story finally got mixed and it aired, and you know, even after a day or so, I'd be like, oh, I wish I had left that detail in there somehow, because I thought it would be interesting for listeners. One example, and I'll just sort of back up. You know, a few months back, we did a program on invasive species, invasive water species of various types, and I went out to tell a story about Phragmites. It's this sort of invasive weed that grows 10 to 12 feet high and just crowds out native plants, and it's really sort of taken over the Great Salt Lake ecosystem and parts of Utah Lake. I went out to do to kind of do an interview or get some tape from there. I guess the Nature Conservancy manages a section of Great Salt Lake, and they had purchased this new big machine. They called it a Marshmaster, and it's designed to be just this sort of mega lawnmower that goes out and cuts down all these Phragmites, and it sprays herbicide. And it just looks like a big tank. And went out there, and there was just kind of a mob of other reporters out there that had gotten the same press release, and they wanted to tell the same story. And the guy that was kind of showing off the Marshmaster talked about, you know, what the machine does and why it's important to get rid of these plants and these invasive weeds. And then, you know, I got to ride on the Marshmaster, and I got some great photos and some great sound, and it was kind of, you know, it was a lot of fun. But the whole time, you know, at the end of the day, I thought just the whole event was really silly because all these reporters went back and told the same story, and I felt like that really wasn't the end of the story. I mean, that was the story was much bigger. So I was thinking, how can I tell this story in a more lively way, in a way that no one else is trying to tell this story? And I was thinking, you know, maybe if I could find some old film that kind of is an invasion film, you know, kind of a monster film, because, you know, maybe we can compare these invasive Phragmites to a monster. And I was kind of going back into my childhood, and I remember the 1984 Steven Spielberg film Gremlins, which at the time I was probably 6 or 7, and I found that film to be really disturbing. And it's an invasion film. You have these little creatures that come into a community and they raise hell. And I thought, well, let's go for it. And so I talked to Karen Kettenring. She's a professor of wetland ecology at Utah State University. And she just kind of described what she's learned about this plant and all the research she's doing to try to make them, you know, to contain them. And I decided to take certain films and excerpts from that film, from the movie Gremlins, and sort of overlap it and kind of try to tell the same story or a similar story to what these Phragmites are doing to the Great Salt Lake ecosystem, similar to what the gremlins did to the poor people in this small town in the movie. But the one thing that I thought that I could have gone further if I had tried, and that was to tell listeners that there actually is a native Phragmites that exists in Utah. Mostly, actually, it lives in southern Utah. It's called Phragmites australis subspecies americanus. And the subspecies of Phragmites, which the invasive form actually came from Europe and then kind of came across from the East Coast of the United States. This native form has been here for a lot longer and has just learned to adapt better. And it doesn't crowd out the native plants, the other native plants where it lives. And I was just thinking, if we're going to continue with this sort of comparison with gremlins, then I would say that this native subspecies of Phragmites, we would call it the mogwai.
What is it?
Mogwai.
What's he doing?
Singing.
Because if you're familiar with the movie, Mogwai is the little furry, cute creature. This little furry guy doesn't terrorize people and is contained. And so, you know, it's funny how, you know, you tell these stories and you're like, oh, I wish I had maybe mentioned that too, or that would have been a better way to continue with the analogy. But anyway.
Well, and I thought, I mean, the gremlins metaphor actually, I mean, worked really, really well. And I do think something that we did leave out of the whole invasive species episode was about native species. You know, invasive is a relative term, right? Mm-hmm. All of these plants are native to somewhere else. And so to just say Phragmites isn't really fair, because mm-hmm. there are tons of different kinds of Phragmites,
right,
and there's
types.
Only one. And of course, we don't want to say the Latin name every single time that we mention it. So we use the word Phragmites as a sort of stand-in for the invasive form. You know, we get so excited about talking about the invasives, and we sort of demonize them. And I think the gremlins, of course, helped to demonize, to sort of put an ugly face on it. And
it did.
To be fair, we have to sort of back up and talk about how ecology works and how, you know, invasive is a relative term.
Absolutely. And I'll just mention it was Halloween, too.
That's
this.
Right.
It was part of a Halloween theme. While we're talking about stories from the past year, for you, what was perhaps one of your favorite field trips, or maybe your most surprising?
Definitely the Walmart beaver story. Ross did some hiking and got to wear waders for his beaver story. My beaver assignment was a little less adventurous.
Really good quality beaver habitat for, you know, thousands of years.
There's like five grocery carts.
I head to the wetlands in the Walmart parking lot.
So the South Walmart in Logan had a beaver problem, and they were trapping and killing beavers, and they'd done it several times because the beaver dam was flooding the parking lot and it was causing a problem.
So I started talking to the person behind that booth, and it was Cammy from Walmart.
This is Dan Miller of the Bear River Watershed Council explaining to me last spring how he caught wind of the Walmart beaver problem.
Just talking about beaver, and she goes, well, you know, I'm kind of sad because we have beaver on our property and the previous manager hired trappers to come in and kill them. And my jaw just dropped. It's like, what?
Cammy Hipwell is the store manager at the South Logan Walmart Supercenter. A small tributary of the Logan River called Spring Creek runs through the parking lot of Cammy's store, and there's essentially an untouched little wetland area in the corner of what can only be described as the most un-wetland place on Earth. And it's home to a thriving beaver pond complex.
I had been studying and reading up on beaver and how they benefit watersheds, and so I knew there were different ways to deal with beaver. And I told Cammy this. I go, there's better ways. You don't have to be exterminating them.
And Dan Miller knew who to call. A team of researchers at Utah State University's Department of Watershed Sciences who specialize in helping people and companies like Walmart live with beaver.
My name's Elijah Portugal, and I'm a geomorphologist with the Fluvial Habitat Center at Utah State University. And I do a variety of work mostly related to beaver. So we, you know, design, plan, and implement beaver-assisted restoration projects.
I actually have an update on the Walmart beavers. Since I interviewed Elijah Portugal last spring about the adaptation plan he created for Walmart and the city of Logan so they could stop trapping and killing beavers, some new beaver pond infrastructure has gone in. I called Elijah up last weekend. He had just been out to visit the Walmart beaver pond that morning, and probably unrelated, he was feeling under the weather. So do you want to describe what happened between, I guess, the last time we met at the Walmart pond, the beaver pond? It was April, and I think a lot has happened since then, and everything was kind of theoretical at that point. I remember you had your plan, the beaver management plan, and it was like a big paper packet, and it was all drawings and things that were not real. have some real things happened since April?
Yeah, they have. We've been able to carry out pretty much all the plans that we outlined in that broader document that we were looking at back in April. I was out there this morning, and the pond levelers are functional. The water height in the ponds behind the dams haven't increased at all since we initially set that height with the pond levelers. And beaver have actually been active around one of the pond levelers and one of the dams. They've added some material to the dam crest, but haven't actually elevated the water surface elevation in the pond behind the dam crest because the pond leveler's doing its job.
And so, the pond leveler is underwater, right? So even if they build it up higher, the water is still going out underneath the dam.
Yeah, yeah, that's basically how they work. Basically, it's just a big flexible pipe. And you have your inlet to the pipe within the pond itself, so upstream of the dam. And then we build a wire mesh cage around that inlet to prevent too much mud or rocks or whatever from getting into that pipe opening. So beaver can continue to extend the height of the dam crest without actually being able to pond any more water up.
So they probably don't even really notice that it's there. I mean, they might be sort of scratching their heads, like, how come our pond isn't getting deeper even though we're building our... I don't know if they're that cognitively aware, but...
They very well could be thinking that. Yeah, it's hard to say how they perceive these pond levelers. It seems like they basically just ignore them.
And so if the ponds are going to flood, I'm guessing, is that like a spring runoff thing? Is that what we're kind of waiting for, the big test?
So, yeah, that's when they really are going to need to be doing their job as efficiently as possible. You know, spring runoff, the timing of that is dependent on what the weather's doing in the spring. But, you know, typically in May, April, May, you're going to be starting to get more water moving down that stream. And so that'll be the big test. And it looks like with the snow that we've been getting so far this winter, that it actually might be a pretty good runoff pull so we get this spring.
I know that this specific project probably got the most attention because it was in a pretty high traffic area. Are you doing other projects in other parts of the state that are sort of similar?
Yeah, so we've got all kinds of different projects going on related to beaver. As far as projects directly related to what we call living with beaver strategies, so like the pond level that we did at Walmart, we have been working on this development of a similar adaptive beaver management plan for Utah Division of Wildlife Resources. They have the Hardware Ranch Wildlife Refuge up Blacksmith Fork here in the south end of Cache Valley. And anyway, they have beaver in there, and they actually installed a pond leveler at our recommendation a couple of years ago. Park City has put in a pond leveler based on our recommendations and based on a plan that my boss, Joe Wheaton, developed as kind of a more involved version of what we did for Walmart. In general, you know, we're interested in the role that beaver play in riverine ecosystems. You know, we believe, you know, the science supports this, that beaver are really keystone species, and they have this profound influence on a host of physical processes within the stream. So these living with beaver strategies, like the Walmart project, and then other types of river restoration projects where we support beaver dam building activities to try and garner the ecological and physical benefits from their dam building. And yeah, we've got a bunch of different projects going on.
Awesome. Well, keep up the good work. And thanks for the update. It's really nice to hear that that project's going well.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, we're happy with how things have turned out.
That was Elijah Portugal with an update on his efforts to keep the Walmart parking lot from flooding so the beavers can stay where they've been for thousands of years. Ross, I hate going to Walmart. It's not my favorite place on earth. But every time I have to go, I go and I park in the far corner and I go visit the beaver, and there's always, red-winged blackbirds chirping, and I see, great blue heron. There's a Virginia rail that lives there, which is a pretty rare bird in Logan. And there's just, it's a corner of the parking lot. It's probably like the size of 10 parking spots. But it got left there when the parking lot went in because it's really an important part of the system there, and so it's this really enjoyable little wetland, and I think that was one of the more surprising stories that I came across.
Yeah, and I love that story too, because it's just another example of that nature is always can be found in the most unexpected places, and you don't have to necessarily go to a national park to see nature. You can go to your local Walmart.
Go to Walmart. So if you're in Logan and you go to the South Walmart, park in the far southwest corner, and go see what the beaver are up to. There are quite a few that live there. They're probably hibernating right now, but they'll be there.
Yeah, that's a great story.
Last August, Ross and I made a program called The Far Reaches of Utah Water that explored how Utah water research was being used outside of Utah, in other states and other countries. Producer Ryan Cunningham took it a step further and reported on Utah's relationship to the search for water on Mars. He probably has the biggest update of the year in water news.
This all started for me when I was thinking about how to live on Mars. Don't get me wrong, Utah's not bad, but sometimes I wish I was about 200 million miles away from the inversion. So I called around, and as it turned out, I wasn't the only person in Utah wondering what it would be like to live on Mars. In fact, right now, at this very moment, there's a team of researchers holed up in a tiny space yurt in the San Rafael Swell, officially referred to as the Mars Desert Research Station, or MDRS. At this faux Mars settlement in the middle of the Utah desert, various research teams study a wide array of logistical challenges that real astronauts could face on the actual Mars. So naturally, I called up one of these would-be Martian explorers for some insight. Engineer Nick Orenstein is an MDRS veteran.
So I treated it like method acting, where I convinced myself for a few days I was on Mars. And it was pretty fun, but also really interesting and informative to give people the psychological experience.
Nick's crew suffered a pretty big mishap in the station's greenhouse.
I looked out the window, and there was a huge flame of fire, like 10 or 15 feet tall, coming from the greenhouse outside. And that is the last thing you expect to see on a day on Mars, is a huge fire.
A quick side note, the Mars Society was able to raise enough money last year to repair the MDRS greenhouse. But back to the fire. To put it out, Nick told me the crew had to use a lot of their water supply. And that got me thinking about how to get water on Mars in the first place. You could deliver water from Earth, we've got plenty of it. But the problem is,
I don't think that you could rely on Earth to keep sending supplies and equipment, including water.
Because it's not very practical to deliver cargo to a distant planet, especially something as heavy as water. But I wasn't ready to give up on my Martian dreams yet, so I sought consolation from NASA scientist Melissa Rice. Melissa's been working with the Mars Curiosity rover to study the red planet's unique geology. She told me there's a chance there might be enough water waiting for us on the Martian surface.
There is water on Mars. There is just not very much of it compared with
the amount of water we have on the Earth and other places in the solar system. And there's no liquid water at the surface of Mars, which is the other big difference. Most of the water is present in the atmosphere as water vapor or in the surface and in the rocks as water ice or as water that is wrapped up in mineral structures.
Oh, if only Mars had liquid water. Wouldn't that just be fascinating?
Good morning. Welcome to NASA headquarters in Washington. My name is Duane Brown with the Office of Communications. Ladies and gentlemen, the journey to Mars just got a whole lot more fascinating.
I kid you not, folks. A month after I talked to Melissa, NASA's Director of Planetary Science, Dr. Jim Green, had some pretty exciting news.
Today, we're revolutionizing our understanding of this planet. Our rovers are finding that there's a lot more humidity in the air than we ever imagined. As we ingest the soils, they're moist, they're hydrated, full of water. These discoveries are very important, but they were only part of the hydrological cycle on Mars that we're just now beginning to understand. What we're going to announce today is that Mars is not the dry, arid planet that we thought of in the past. Today we're going to announce that under certain circumstances, liquid water has been found on Mars.
Is it fair of me to wonder if Melissa Rice had a hunch about these findings when I interviewed her in August? Maybe. But is it also fair of me to assume that maybe NASA didn't want a freelance public radio reporter to break the news of one of the biggest scientific discoveries in the history of our solar system? Yeah, I think so. But what matters is we have more reason than ever to go to Mars. If you're a planetary geologist like Melissa, you might be interested in studying the planet's potentially soggy soil. Or if you're Nick Orenstein, you might just be looking for a tall, refreshing glass of water.
I can't wait to drink a glass that didn't come from Earth. Yeah, so that's what I'm working for, that cold glass of water.
As for me, well, it'd just be nice to get away from this Utah inversion. For The Source, I'm Ryan Cunningham. There's a starman waiting in the sky. He'd like to come and meet us, but he thinks he'd blow our minds. There's a starman waiting in the sky. He's told us not to blow it, cause he knows it's all worthwhile. He told me, let the children use it. Let the children use it. Let all the children do get. You're listening to the final episode of The Source. We'll be right back.
Hey, what's up? I'm Shad. Khemez Daule is a band made up of four Syrian refugees who left their home after their drummer was killed in the country's uprising. Next time on Q, I'll speak with their lead singer about sharing music during their migration and what life is like in their new home. That's coming up on Q from PRI, Public Radio International.
Join us today at 1 on Utah Public Radio.
Support for The Source on Utah Public Radio comes from the USU Utah Water Research Laboratory and the USU College of Agriculture and Applied Sciences, celebrating the 2015 Year of Water, water expertise at its source. And iUtah, helping to shape Utah's water future through statewide research, science, and education.
This is The Source. I'm Jennifer Pemberton in the studio with Ross Chambliss for this last episode of The Source.
Being that this is the wrap-up show, we shouldn't end before we talk about maybe our thoughts on what was the most important story, perhaps, of this past year.
I mean, there were so many important stories, and a lot of things happened this year. I mean, the Year of Water, 2015 was the Year of Water, and that was a Utah State University designation, it was basically a marketing campaign, but it was a way to sort of think about and focus on the research that was happening. And so by running this show for a whole year, it just made us, you know, think about the entire year as it pertains to water and water stories and the news that was happening. And so it was an interesting sort of way to chart the calendar and to think about the seasons passing. The story that got under my skin the most, I think, and that I sort of tracked all year, think it was in our second episode, we talked about the Great Salt Lake. So this would have been February or March. So it was early in the year. It was sort of winter, almost a year ago. And I'd heard that the Great Salt Lake was shrinking. And the Great Salt Lake goes through these cycles every year. Obviously, the water runs, melts out of the mountains and runs into the lake, and it fills up, and then it evaporates over the summer, and it sort of goes through the cycle every year. But even with that cycle, the trend is downwards. We're losing water out of the Great Salt Lake. And I didn't sort of think about that as being a really big deal. And I think I was like a lot of people in that the Great Salt Lake, we all know it's salty. You know, you can't drink the water. It smells bad. People think of it as kind of a dump, and historically they used it as a dump.
It was.
And it is where the sewage, granted it's treated, but the wastewater from Salt Lake City ends up in the Great Salt Lake, and it's kind of an unpleasant place to be. And so I never really thought about it as a place you could go and hang out, and that it was ecologically rich or interesting or anything. And so I started reading about Terminal Lake. So the Great Salt Lake is the end of the line. It's salty because it doesn't have an outlet and it evaporates, and what's left behind is a lot of minerals and a lot of just straight up salt. And I was reading about other salt lakes because they're really unique. And salt lakes, terminal lakes throughout the world, are all threatened and they are all drying up because we're using the water before it gets there. It's not, I mean, part of it is about climate change and part of it is about things heating up and evaporating. But another big part of it is that we're using that water for irrigation, for drinking, for everything before it gets there. And why wouldn't you? The idea for a long time was any drop of water that makes it to the Great Salt Lake is a waste. Like, what you know, once it hits the Salt Lake, you can't drink it, you can't irrigate with it, you can't do anything with it. That's still a management perspective that's in play.
Wow.
So I ended up talking to a guy named Wayne Wurzbach, who is in the Watershed Sciences Department at Utah State University, and he was talking about this lake in Iran called Lake Urmia. And Lake Urmia is really interesting because it's a twin to the Great Salt Lake. It looks exactly like the Great Salt Lake. They are like the same distance across. It has a causeway that it's a driving causeway, not a railroad causeway, but it's a bridge basically that cuts across the middle of the lake and separates the halves, which is what's going on in the Great Salt Lake. So it's an interesting sort of experiment that's already in play. And some of the researchers from Iran, from Lake Urmia, called researchers in Utah and were like, hey, our lake's drying up. How come your lake looks so good? And the researchers in Utah, who are, of course, like, our lake is very threatened and we're very worried about this downward trend in the Great Salt Lake, realized, I guess, in some ways, how much worse it could be. And there were several factors of why it was worse in Iran than it was here. There are a lot more people depending on it. It's closer to the equator, so it's warmer and they have more evaporation, things like that. But I didn't realize how precious the Great Salt Lake was. And so I've been watching it eagerly this whole year. I actually go to the U.S. Geological website and check the lake gauge every once in a while. And and just in December of 2015, so sort of as a weird recap itself of the end of the year of water, the Great Salt Lake in the north arm of the Great Salt Lake got to its lowest level in history, like in recorded history, which is really, really troubling. And it was a sort of blip, you know, in the news cycles. But for me, having learned this about the lake and watching this play out all year, I will never think about the Great Salt Lake the same way again. I wanted to do a follow-up story on the lake level, so I called Corey Angeroth with the U.S. Geological Survey as soon as I heard the news about the historic low.
Well, we had been watching it. We knew that the north arm of Great Salt Lake was on its way down.
Angeroth is a hydrologist with the U.S. Geological Survey, and he's in charge of monitoring the lake and river levels across the state.
The USGS has operated a lake level gauge on the north arm of Great Salt Lake since April of 1966. We've been operating lake gauges on Great Salt Lake in general since September of 1875.
The Great Salt Lake is essentially two bodies of water right now, separated by the Union Pacific Railroad tracks that span the lake on a raised causeway.
The big rivers that feed the lake, the Bear, the Weber, and the Jordan, they all flow into the lake to the south of that causeway.
When the causeway was put in 1959, it had two culverts in it that allowed for, well, originally, it's my understanding that they were put in for navigational purposes so that boats could travel between the north arm and south arm, and that allowed the two levels of the lake to be more equal and also to allow for mixing of the waters. So in 1963, when the record low was recorded in the south arm, the two arms of the lake were more equal at that time than they are now.
The culverts were closed a few years ago. They were in bad shape, kind of closing in on themselves already as they started crumbling.
That always had a pathway for water to flow from the south arm to the north arm. But now that the culverts and the causeway have been closed, the causeway is really just kind of acting like a dam.
The water in the larger south arm of the lake is about 2 feet higher right now, which sounds nice, but it's hovering within a foot of its own historic low. There are plans to punch a new hole through the causeway this year to allow water to flow back and forth again. But depending on when that happens, it could mean that the whole lake drops down below its low record.
If we get an above-average snowpack, that would be great for the lake. If we get a below-average snowpack, then there is the potential that we could be seeing a record low.
The record low in the north arm of the lake is a reflection of how little precipitation we've gotten in the past year, and a shrinking lake means that more lake bed is exposed to the elements. It also means that some of the islands in the lake are no longer islands. You could actually walk to Antelope Island from the lakeshore right now. That's bad news for the birds that nest on these usually isolated beaches. But scientists like Corey Angeroth are looking on the bright side of this hydrologic anomaly.
This is really kind of a big experiment going on where we've got the north arm and south arm separated from each other. And when this new breach is opened up later on this year, it'll be very interesting, and we're hoping to be able to get out there and do some more monitoring to see how the lake responds to this change from being basically two separate lakes right now to going back to being a more connected lake.
I always think it's interesting how scientists think. What some people see as catastrophe, they see as unprecedented experimentation opportunities. Kind of puts it into perspective, I guess. I've been kind of doing my own non-scientific monitoring of the Great Salt Lake this year, and for me, the story about the shrinking lake was an all-encompassing one. It was the story that really stuck with me, and it made me think differently about water. As a metaphor, for a stand-in, for our relationship with our watershed here in Utah, I don't know, it really kind of changed me.
Wow. And certainly it's a story to be continued, right?
Yeah.
Reaching the lowest level ever. What does that mean? We're going to have to just kind of wait and find out.
Yeah. How low will it go?
Yeah. Wow. Well, for me, I felt like the top story of 2015, the top water story for 2015 was one that we kind of touched on in a few places, but not directly with a story, but it did get a lot of media attention overall. And that was the legislative water audit that came out kind of towards the end of the summer, or early fall. This was a legislative audit of the Division of Water Resources and basically where they were getting their water numbers from. And it basically found that the division was not using reliable data, that they found that there were significant inaccuracies of the division's data. It questioned the reliability of the division's baseline water use study. And this was the study that projected Utah's future water needs that was based on what they said was old data from 1992 to 1999, for example, and which may not have given an accurate representation of Utah's future water needs. So it was a big deal because it says the division needs to go back to the drawing board and figure out where do we stand? How much water are we using as a state? But it is also a big deal because that really impacts the projected water use, and are we necessarily going to have to spend more money, billions of dollars, on water development projects in the future? And specifically, the Bear River and Lake Powell Pipeline. The Bear River Dam proposal, which it seems is a little further off than the Lake Powell Pipeline. The Lake Powell pipeline proposal is said to be needed a lot sooner, you know, like early 2020, 2022 perhaps is when supposedly St. George is going to run out of water. Bear River is perhaps a decade or so down the line, but it's certainly something that would affect all of us living here on the Wasatch Front as far as where we get our water and certainly how it would impact the Great Salt Lake and its water levels. Again, just a story that's not going to go away. It's going to continue and perhaps be more of an important story in the years to come. So we'll see.
A lot of people that we talked to this year in various water management roles, you know, they always say that, you know, one of the best sources of new water is conservation. I mean, we can't just keep finding. You know, it's not like gold. It's not like we're going to discover, you know, the mother load of water. We know where all the water is. And the only place that we're going to get more water is if we're wiser about how we use our water. And that's, you know, I learned about that through the dam episode and the drought episode and the episode about the Great Salt Lake. I mean, it got mentioned so many times.
It's a recurring theme.
And that was the big thing with the audit. It's like the state's trying to figure out how much water we're going to need and how much money we're going to need to spend to get it. And it's not an easy task to figure that out. And there are a lot of great minds sort of on the job, and there are a lot of great people policing the people who are on that job too. So that is an ongoing story. That is what's happening in the state right now. And just because the year of water is over and just because the source is over doesn't mean that we're not going to keep our eye on it, and it doesn't mean that it's going away anytime soon.
It makes me sad, you know, to hear that the source is over.
It's definitely bittersweet. Oh.
It is. But it was a fun year. It was a good year.
It sure was.
Yeah.
All right. Well, okay. For The Source, I'm Jennifer Pemberton.
And I'm Ross Chambliss.
The Source is produced at the studios of Utah Public Radio with major support from iUtah. I'm Jennifer Pemberton. I produced all 12 episodes of The Source in the pleasant company of Ross Chambliss and Ryan Cunningham in Salt Lake City. There would have certainly not been a program without those two, and I'm eternally grateful for their involvement, their willingness, and their contributions. The program also receives some help from the staff at Utah Public Radio, especially Carrie Bringhurst, Tom Williams, and Bennett Purser, under the direction of General Manager Peg Arnold. Megan Simper wrote and performed our theme song, and I don't think I've ever mentioned this before, but she wrote the song for this show. I asked for something watery and sciencey, not too sad, but not too upbeat, something kind of folky, kind of flowy. And somehow she translated that commission into what you hear each month at the beginning of the show. It's a gift, really, and I'm thankful for it. And of course, thank you for caring about water in our state. All 12 episodes of The Source are up on upr.org if you want to revisit them. I'm Jennifer Pemberton. Thank you for listening.
Here are events going on all around Utah this week. Utah State University presents Electrification Towards a Sustainable Future for Our Transportation System, hosted by Dr. Regan Zane, UStar Professor of Electrical and Computer Engineering, featuring a complimentary breakfast. Event at the Little America Hotel in Salt Lake City from 7 to 9 p.m. on Friday, January 29th. The Cache Regional Overland Winter Backcountry Race hosts a ski mountaineering race held annually in Logan on Saturday, January 30th, featuring races, junior divisions, food, and more. Backcountry avalanche gear required. The Uinta Conference Center in Vernal hosts Entrepreneur Simplified Business Workroom, featuring a workshop for entrepreneurs and small business owners to assist in evaluating, building, and creating an action plan. Event starts Thursday, February 4th from 12:30 to 3 p.m. To view events or to submit your own, visit our community calendar page at upr.org.
This is KUSR HD1 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1 88.7 Moab, KCEU 89.7 Price, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.
You're listening to Utah Public Radio, a service of the College of Humanities and Social Sciences at Utah State University.